This is GameTree.biz Microcast. I am James Batchelor, and I'm joined this week, as ever, by Christopher Dring. How are you, sir?
I'm great.
Good.
Invigorated. I'm feeling optimistic because we wrote some pieces on Friday which were not "The World is Going to Die."
We did. It was nice ending the week on "These are the things that the industry has got to look forward to." And like, not just you, but Brendan as well in This Week in Business had a slightly optimistic, which, I mean, I can't remember the last time I had an optimistic This Week in Business to run on the site. So
It was semi-optimistic.
It wasn't
heavily caveated optimism is the
But that's the type of optimism you get with Brendan. Heavily caveated optimism is his brand of optimism. Yeah. So it was excellent.
That's what who thought?
It's my watch. My watch has started talking.
Well, question for you or your watch. And did you catch the State of Play, the PlayStation State of Play? And what was your highlight?
I did catch State of Play, and it was, you know, I like the Xbox One. You know, there was a lot of good stuff in there. Nothing that I thought, wow, it's going to change things.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a good State of Play. For me, Ken Levine's back, right?
Yeah.
And that's got to be my highlight because it's been 10 years. It's like 10 years since Bioshock Infinite, and since he decided to close Irrational and sort of make a game quicker with a smaller team, and then take 10 years to make a game that looks an awful lot like Bioshock. But hey, I'm on board. Like, I'm not to be cynical about it, but I'm interested.
So this is the thing. I've seen a lot of, I've heard like
Judas,
a lot of podcasts.
Judas is the game.
I've heard a lot of criticism, but I've heard a lot of comments and like snide remarks and stuff like on Twitter or on podcasts or whatever, like, you know, that Ken Levine is just making another game that looks like Bioshock. Bioshock is like one of the best games I've ever played. Like the Bioshock games, all three of them are amazing. So why would we not want something like Bioshock?
We've also not had one of those. I mean, it just looks a little bit. I'm sure it's different. We've not had a game like Bioshock, really. Well, I guess you had some of those arcane games, sort of, you know, a little bit. But I'm on board. I thought that looked just to me. I like Silent Hill's back. I'm not convinced, but I also. But I want to be. So that was interesting. I quite like the look of those sort of things as well. But yeah, I thought it was solid. It was there was a lot of good stuff. I think if you're a PlayStation fan, if you're into those sort of franchises, there was plenty there for you to get excited about. I know there wasn't too much first party, Death Stranding obviously, but technically not a Microsoft studio, not a Sony studio.
Yeah.
It had the. I tell you what I saw, which I hadn't seen from PlayStation for a while, was announcing a game that isn't in the works yet.
Yes,
you know, I used to do that all the time. It used to be their MO for early PS4 generation, but announcing basically a new Metal Gear Solid, but not Kojima,
yeah.
When he's finished making the two games he's making already. But that made me smile. I miss those days.
See, stupid. Aside from Judas, that was my highlight. Was, oh great, a new Kojima stealth game, because I love my stealth games, and like, his are great. I can't get into Death Stranding and that sort of thing. It's just not my sort of thing.
It's a weird game, Death Stranding.
It's weird, yeah. It's weird. And watching the sequel, it doesn't look any less weird. The one thing that disappointed me about Death Stranding 2 was, I remember interviewing Kojima before he started working on Death Stranding. He was talking about how, I think he referred to it as like the stick and the rope. And like most games are built, like the concept of like the tools of humanity are the stick and the rope. And most people make games around the stick, i.e. you beat people with a stick. And he wanted to make a game around the rope, as in connecting people. And that became Death Stranding and the whole network connecting thing. And there's definitely a reference in the trailer to both stick and rope, but this looked a lot more combat centric. And it's kind of a shame to see him go the other way with it.
Is it called Death Stranding 2 on the beach?
It is called Death Stranding 2 on the beach.
You gotta love that.
You gotta love that. Also, last point on Death Stranding and State of Play in general. I love how I've seen a couple of comments and stuff like, you know, only Kojima would be crazy enough to come up with like an electric guitar that is also a lightning gun. Those people have clearly never seen Despicable Me 3, where they've done the same thing with a synth keyboard. Like, Kojima's clearly a parent, or at least an Illumination fan.
He loves all films, doesn't he?
He does love all films. Okay, let's dive into some larger stories from the last week. First of all, one that's actually picked up over this past weekend. There's rumours and sources and reports going on that Xbox is bringing a number of first-party titles to other systems, specifically PlayStation 5. The two titles that are being touted as being ported are Indiana Jones and the Great Circle, which was unveiled last month. Big first-party title. It's coming from Machine Games, coming out in autumn. I can't wait. Sorry, Indiana Jones fanboy moment there. And then Starfield is rumoured to be coming to PlayStation 5, apparently after the, I think it's the Shattered Space is the name of the expansion. Once the expansion's out, they'll then bring it to PlayStation 5. They're rumours at this stage, we have to kind of emphasise that. But I think it's interesting to talk about Microsoft's attitude to bringing its properties to other platforms.
Yeah. I've heard similar stories. I haven't heard those two games. I've heard sort of, I'm not going to name them. You know, I'm not that kind of journalist that just drops stuff in podcasts, despite what happened last week. I've heard of there are games coming to PlayStation and Switch, and they're games that don't necessarily contradict. I don't think it would harm the Xbox console business necessarily. They're sort of smaller games, niche games, older games. Not all of them, but they will. You know, the ones I've heard, you go, oh yeah, that makes sense, right? Starfield and Indiana Jones are like big system sellers, so I'm a little bit more surprised by that. Regardless of what the rumor is, it doesn't. Microsoft has been beaten by PlayStation. My comparison to this, by the way, and I'm actually started toying around with a piece about it, is not Sega. Everyone's comparing it to Sega. For me, it's more comparable to Nintendo. When Nintendo came out of the GameCube, Nintendo had lost to PlayStation. They could not beat PlayStation. They ended up going, what do we do? They go, well, who isn't PlayStation talking to? You know, what could we do instead? What's our, and then they came up with Project Revolution, which is an unusual act of hubris for a company. It's just been soundly thrashed in the console space, and they went in a different way in a different market, and they sort of end up having to pivot again when Apple came along. But they just went, right, you know, this isn't real war. Like, people aren't actually defeated when they lose. Like, they go and do different things, and they go and react. Microsoft's revolution for a while has been not hardware related, like the Wii remote, but more business models and you know, platforms and distribution and reach new audiences and new territories, and that, obviously, by the way, as a given, games are a part of that, right? The Wii remote wouldn't have worked without Wii Sports, and Microsoft's current strategy won't work without a good software lineup. But that's what they're trying to do. And actually, releasing games on other platforms, it's not only does it not contradict that strategy, it's actually part of that strategy. You have to release your games on other platforms. Obviously, they don't have to release it on PlayStation 5, because PS5 isn't the big mark, isn't the big opportunity. That's mobile, it's PC. But I just think, in terms of making a bit of cash, you know, it doesn't contradict their main strategy. They know they've got to move beyond the console in order to be relevant and bigger, to be on the biggest games companies in the world, which they already are. And you know, you put some of these titles on PlayStation, you'll find a new audience, you'll make some money. It's worth noting that a lot of these games, you know, particularly on the Xbox exclusive ones, most people are accessing them via Game Pass, so their revenues are a lot lower than their player numbers are really high, but their revenue would be a lot lower than it would have been if they were premium titles, potentially, not for all of them. And so, you know, get a couple of these games on PlayStation, you'll find a decent audience. I think there's a balancing act, right, between bringing games to more platforms, because they do have a console business. I know I said they've been beaten, but they've still got a console business that still makes money for them. It's still very successful. They've got a fan base that love it. So they'll want to balance releasing games on other platforms with maintaining that business for as long as they can. But it's certainly interesting. They've done this before, right? Ori and the Will of the Wisp, Ori and the Blind Forest came to Switch. And we talk about the rare games and all that kind of stuff, but you can understand that. But Ori and the Will of the Wisp, Ori and the Blind Forest, Microsoft-funded games that they ported to Nintendo platforms, published them as well. They aren't Banjo-Kazooie. There's no legacy there with those games. Now, it made sense. They're 2D Metroidvania games. Switch loves 2D Metroidvania games. So it kind of made sense as an audience perspective. It was a business opportunity. Nobody really made much of a fuss about it when it happened. everyone's like, oh, that's interesting, and then sort of moved on. And this, for me, this is sort of similar. Starfield is on a different scale. I hadn't heard Starfield, but even then, it would be over a long time. If you wanted to play Starfield when it came out, you had to have an Xbox or a PC. It's certainly, I'd love to hear from Xbox. If this is what they're doing, and there's a lot of people saying that it is where they're going, I'd like to hear from them and understand a little bit what the end game is, because I think I know, but I'm not them.
Yeah, I would be very, very interested to have that conversation with Microsoft right now. I think, like you said, like, you know, the go-to comparison that people have been making, and I have to confess, even like the thought occurred to me, like, you know, will they go full-blown Sega? Not anytime soon, but will they kind of drop the hardware side of things and just become a third-party publisher? That thought occurs. But the comparison's not the same. It's not the same comparison. It's not like for like. Because as you were kind of pointing out earlier, like, and as you've just pointed out, like, they've already done this. We've already seen Microsoft titles on other platforms. You know, one of the best-selling titles on PlayStation is a Microsoft title. It's Minecraft. Like, Minecraft
the best-selling third-party game on Switch is Minecraft.
Exactly.
The best-selling game on PlayStation is Call of Duty, also a Microsoft title.
Minecraft's like the biggest selling game of all time now, and that is primarily during, like, that's all primarily built up during its Microsoft ownership. So it's not unheard of for Microsoft to release titles on other platforms, as you say. I think the scale of these makes it interesting. Like, I'm kind of divided on it. On the one hand, I'm like, I remember when Starfield was confirmed as an Xbox exclusive, and I remember thinking, well, that makes sense, because you own the studio. It's potentially a system-selling sort of game. You would absolutely want that on your system. But now, with Microsoft kind of reaching out kind of broader than just its own box, and, you know, its box being the lowest-selling box of the three, it does make sense to put these big... So obviously, given timed exclusivity on your own systems, but it does make sense to kind of put them on the other ones and get that audience, if you can, to kind of... you know, just build up Microsoft and build up you know, Xbox's brand as a purveyor of games across all platforms. That makes sense to me. Or Starfield on PlayStation, or Indie on PlayStation, because that sounds a bit more solid, perhaps. Indie on PlayStation will make a much bigger splash than Ori and the Will-O-The-Wisps on Switch. It will. Yeah. So yeah, you can understand why they're going to go that way, if that's what they're doing.
Well, I sort of can. What I because Phil Spencer once said he'd put all games on any platform that he could put Game Pass on, right? And that made sense to me, because that's their platform, effectively. We think of platform as a console, but actually for Xbox, it's Game Pass is a platform, and Xbox Live is a platform, and these are all platforms. And as long as they can have an audience and an ecosystem, it doesn't matter what device it's on necessarily. But obviously, nobody's suggesting Game Pass is coming to PlayStation. I'd be shocked if that happened.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit surprised by it, because I don't quite know. Is it just, let's get Starfield a couple of million more players and actually make $70 a pop on each box release, right? Is it that? Or is it a short-term money thing? Or is it a longer-term, hey, we're putting Starfield on PlayStation so everyone can go, oh, I like this Starfield game. Oh, hang on, I could get this on PC and other devices in a subscription. I don't know. I haven't quite... That's the bit that I haven't... Is this really a strategic decision, or is it more of a short-term financial one? And that's the bit that I haven't quite leapt to in my mind. You know, it's not like it's a live service game in the way that, you know, Sea of Thieves or something like that is. Those games, I'd like, for me, make a lot of sense to be as multi-platform as possible, because it benefits those games potentially quite substantially. But it harms those games not to be multi-platform. But yeah, that's the bit I haven't quite grasped that. Here's the thing, though. All the platform holders are now multi-platform game developers. You know, the idea... Yeah. They're all obviously Xbox on a bigger scale, but PlayStation games are all on PC. And I know people go, oh, the audiences are different. But they are, but they're also not. There's definitely crossover there. Yeah. And, you know, Nintendo released their games on iPhone. And it... You know, I would argue iPhone has had a bigger negative impact upon Nintendo's business than PlayStation or Xbox have over the last 10 years, the last 10, 15 years. Mm. So I know that these are different. People don't see them as the same because of console war rhetoric and stuff, but they are still devices that play games, and these companies are releasing their games on them. And I, you know, the console audience has been 200, 250 million players now for 20 odd years. It hasn't grown. And they've been able to monetize those players more. That your costs of making those games have gone up. They've been able to monetize players more through microtransactions, through DLCs, through subscription. But eventually, there's a ceiling on that. And eventually, they're going to have to go, how do we get these console games to a bigger audience? And the solution to that is new markets, multi-platform, new business models, and new devices.
Agreed. I'm going to pick up on that lovely little segue you set up for me and talk about live service games, because I think, yeah, with this Microsoft stuff, there's not really much to say until Microsoft actually explains what the heck it's doing. But live service has also been a big topic of conversation over the last few days, primarily because of a report that came out from Griffin Gaming Partners. Now, according to their survey of 537 studios across the globe, 95% of those studios are developing or maintaining a live service game. Now, it's important at this point to define a live service game. According to the survey, a live service game is any game with regular update cadence planned. So constantly getting kind of new content and so forth.
So all games.
Yeah, all games potentially, yeah. I mean, it's different though. It's not like it's... So I think we've all been having this conversation. Different people have different definitions of live service. I kind of see live service as any game. Typically, your live service game that first springs to mind is your multiplayer-centric, microtransaction-riddled, you know, events-based, you know, battle passes, that sort of stuff. Like, you know, like your Fortnites, your, you know, Marvel Snaps, your stuff like that. Yeah, like Destiny, those sort of games. Technically, though, like other games are treated as live service. Ubisoft has been doing this with Assassin's Creed for a good couple of years. Like, you know, Valhalla and Odyssey were both treated like live service in terms of they had additional content and updates and, you know, in-game events and stuff released for ages afterwards. Like, it's a very kind of broad term, live service, and I think people have got a very kind of narrow, myself included sometimes, like a very kind of narrow view of it. A lot of the kind of criticism that's been around Suicide Squad, for example, which has just come out, has been because, oh, you know, it's Rocksteady moving away from that kind of Batman Arkham style and making more of a kind of a live service game because it's a multiplayer centric, it's looter shooter, it looks like it's going to be something that, you know, there's a roadmap of content, like that sort of stuff. I think, you know, the live service elements of some games, particularly I'm thinking of Suicide Squad, apologies. I think there's resistance among players to live service. I think live service like kind of gets some heckles up for people. It's, you know, it's like, oh God, we're now going to be charged. We're going to be nickeled and dimed. We're going to be dragged out. Like, you know, all the funds have been drained out. I think that's the perception out there.
I think it's also fatigue. I think it's just an element of, can you just give me a game I can finish?
Yes, massively
And I think there's a little bit of that. Obviously, that you're talking very specifically of the hardcore gaming audience that sort of
shout
about these things. But there is certainly an appetite, I think. But yeah, for things that are aren't going to, they've released another DLC update and it's just, you just want to be able to play, you know. I think all of us do. I love live service games. I play it with, you know, a massive Sea of Thieves fan, but you know, I don't only want to play Sea of Thieves, and I don't want the next game I play to be another Sea of Thieves. I want it to be probably a 10-hour story game that would do me just fine. And I think that's all of us want. It's the games industry. I've been doing this for, you know, nearly 20 years, and every time there's a trend. Sometimes it's a genre. Sometimes it's a business model. Sometimes it's a piece of hardware. Everyone rushes in. Oh, my goodness. And, of course, games take longer now, so it takes a little bit longer for the rush in to sort of really be appreciated. Live service isn't new, but everyone seems to want to have a live service game now. I actually think we're at the cusp where people are going, actually, maybe we stop. I think we are getting, because I think the thing is as much premium games have got really expensive, you know, single player narrative games. If you can work out how to make those games efficiently and on a budget, they're sort of a relatively guaranteed, you can guarantee that you can make, you know, you can not guarantee how much money you're going to make, but you feel a little bit more confident that you will make some money. You release a live service game, you have no idea if it's just free to play, you have no idea if you're going to make a single penny, and you're banking on there being an audience. You've got a developer there for a longer period of time. And look how many live service games have actually broken into that top tier of engaged games. Like, it's still the same, still GTA Online, it's still Fortnite, it's still Candy Crush, it's still Call of Duty, it's still the same games, still FIFA Ultimate Team. And it's every now and again one breaks in, it's very exciting. But when you think about how many are coming out, to have one every now and again break in, it's a bit even the ones that do break in and get really exciting for a little bit disappear. Among Us and those sort of games disappear quite quickly. It's really hard to maintain it because you're competing with all these people who've got their their league tables and their fan audience and their friends and stuff in other live service titles. It's really difficult. And I think you're going to get developers recognise this and actually think it's less risky to just go, here's a 20-hour story game. Because they now, with subscription and stuff, there's ways to monetize that post-launch as well once you've got out of that brief period. So I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing people... I think games will always get updated and tweaked and stuff over time, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see a shift back from... My thing, though, is the games industry shifts back and then nobody does it. You remember the time everyone was making a Call of Duty clone? And now nobody makes a clone.
No one does.
There's only shooter out there is Call of Duty. I'm like, there is room for more than one. You don't have to all stop. I remember when people used to make 3D platforms. Now nobody does.
Yeah,
and it was just like there's a middle ground between there being too much and then being.
It's that all or nothing attitude you see from a lot of. Certainly, like a lot of the bigger companies are like, we either need this to be right up there, top tier, earning millions, or we scrap it. And I think there really does need to be that middle ground of like experimenting with stuff, providing you recoup your costs, whether that is with a live service game or with a shorter single player program. Providing you recoup your costs and ideally get some level of profit, that should be enough to keep the business going. I grant you, I don't run a business, I don't have shareholders to answer to, but like ideally that would be enough. There is
a growth element to it. The thing is, what I say about live service, people criticise it, but I actually think it helps for a more sustainable industry generally. Like if you're a company with a decent live service title, it doesn't matter if a few of your games flop or they don't quite hit, because you've got that undercurrent of regular recurring revenue that's just keeping things. Oh, that didn't work, but that's fine. You know, we've got it's okay. We had this guaranteed revenue. Whereas when you hit back to the hit based industry of like you're releasing five games and two of them have to hit, or you're going to have to start laying things off, we're in trouble. Right? That was always people talk about the industry being unstable now, and it is, but it's going for a moment rather than something that was permanently an issue for like several years. You know, you had to have people, Activision would release 10 games in a year and all it needed was two of them to do the numbers, and it made up for the eight that failed. And it's just that was never a nice industry to sort of be part of. I think that sustainability, that regular revenue is useful, particularly for those really big companies that want to do stuff in AAA. And I think live service enables that. There isn't room. We don't have time for all of these games. And I think, I'm looking at what Sony's doing, and I saw Naughty Dog pulled away from it. And I think maybe there's an element of actually when we get close to release, we have to ask ourselves, are we really ready to commit to this? Because if it's tough and we are competing with ourselves.
And that's the thing, like, live services are... As much as a lot of the a common criticism against live service games, and I'm using that in the broad, stereotypical sense that people look at them, a lot of the criticism is that they are just out to kind of monetize you as much as possible and dominate, consume as much of your income as possible. But they're also out there, as you say, to consume much of your time. Like, they're built to require daily logins and constant chat. And they're built on the assumption, or perhaps the hope, that you're not going to play anything else. And that, I mean, I'm talking personally, I can't be alone on this, like, that kind of puts me off. Like, I finally tried Palworld the other day, and it was like, okay, interesting ideas, reasonably good execution, I see why people are really enjoying this. I have absolutely no time for it. I do not have the time to pour into it. But it's clearly built with the assumption that you are going to play this and this alone. And games overall aren't like that. Like, games are a medium that people do... I mean, I grant you, millions of people do dedicate themselves to one title, but millions of other people do kind of play a variety, and live service doesn't allow for that.
I think industry-wide it's a challenge. I think if EA aren't bothered about it, but I think if you're not bothered, that other publishers are struggling to find audiences. But yeah, is it PlayStation revealed last year, 1 million people on PS5, or just PlayStation platforms generally, only play Call of Duty?
Yeah.
That's mad. Like, they're not PlayStation. They're not PlayStation players. They're Call of Duty players. Yeah. That's their, that is an industry we live in. People play. I've got a bunch of friends that only play FIFA or EA Sports FC, and that's a shame. They used to play more. They don't need to now. They've been engaged by their game, and I think it has potential long-term implications, but I do think we might see a bit of a push away from it.
Well, I await the push with anticipation. That is all we've got time for today. Chris, thank you so much for joining me, as always.
Thank you. Oh, always delight, isn't it, James?
It's
always.
Good. It's good. It's my Monday morning highlight. We are going to be back next Monday with another Microcast. You can find all previous episodes of the Microcast on the podcasting platform of your choice, as well as our full-blown podcast, which will return at some point. The last few Microcasts are on our YouTube channel, and you can get more news, insight, and You get double the insight. News, insight, and analysis into the world behind video games at gamesindustry.biz.